I must admit, as I suggested earlier, to some very mixed feelings and indeed experiences of Advent. Part of me is always very taken by the opportunity for some reflection, for contemplation, and the intention to purposefully anticipate Christmas. And the more pragmatic bit of me recognises that the start of Advent means there's shed loads to do in the course of the next 4 weeks, and I begin to make copious lists through which I work as and when I've got a few minutes. And then it all really happens. The rising panic starts, which becomes increasingly dominant in my thinking. Will I ever be prepared in time for Christmas? Will I have done what's necessary to ensure that those people around me, family, friends, colleagues, can really celebrate this important festival? And the question of opportunity cost, what other important things am I missing as I respond to that awful question that people keep asking you, are you ready for Christmas, takes over. There are many good things about working in a hospice, but nothing more than the proportionality that it offers to my rather ludicrous worries. It's obvious to say, but absolutely true in my experience, when you're dealing with a serious illness, a diagnosis of a terminal condition, or the prospect of a major bereavement, all things silly and inconsequential fall away. And by the same token, the things that are really important become crystal clear. Consequently, whatever the other frustrations of our work at the hospice, rarely do we have to deal with the frivolous or the irrelevant. And for that reason, I'm going to draw on my experience of hospice life to consider the four themes of Advent, the four last things of man: death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And this is because I am confident that there's much more to learn about what these mean in our lives from those whose focus is no longer on the peripheral and the unimportant. Instead, the individuals I meet in my work are focused absolutely on what it means to be alive and the beauties and indeed the ugliness therein, the heaven and the hell of life, the proximity of death, judgment, and at times a search for or indeed an experience of redemption. So, somewhat at odds with the order of these themes, established in Christian eschatology, let's start with the picture of heaven. I realise that in saying to you that I can see glimpses of heaven in hospice life, that may be something of a surprise. But if I had a pound for every time somebody says, I never thought that a hospice would be like this, I wouldn't need to work. There's often lots and lots of laughter. People talk about seeing somewhere that's light rather than dark, feeling warmth and care, and experiencing a huge sense of optimism despite the gravity of the situation of most people there. In fact, it's one of the paradoxes of hospice care. Before people come into a hospice, it's the last place on God's earth they'd ever want to be. And when we have to say goodbye to somebody, when we discharge somebody, it's one of the most challenging things we ever do. Nobody ever wants to be discharged from hospice care, even when it's a sign that they're getting better. And I have looked after particularly one lady who I sent to St. Joseph's Hospice when I worked in a really gruesome hospital. And she made an almost miraculous recovery, and I had to go and tell her that she had to leave. And to this day, if I see her in Tesco's, she always says, that is the lady who made me leave St. Joseph's. So it can be very difficult. So let me tell you about the glimpses of heaven that I see in my work. Perhaps one of the best bits about our job, and perhaps one of the most extraordinary bits of what we do, is about helping people do what's really important to them. And I remember clearly when I first arrived at St. Christopher's last year, meeting a rather extraordinary couple called John and Sandra. John was on our inpatient unit. He had a learning difficulty and he was coming to the end of his life. And he had a long-term partnership with a woman called Sandra, who also had a learning difficulty. And they'd been partners probably for about 10 years, but they had never been encouraged to be married because people never really took their partnership seriously. And for John, it was one of the most important things that he could do. And so with the help of our chaplain, he was married to Sandra in our, actually in a conservatory on our ward, just days before he died. They didn't have lots of family. We have a very handsome cook who was the best man. We had a nurse who was chosen to be the bridesmaid, and a good time was had by all. And he died knowing that he'd done what he wanted to do most. Importantly, Sandra has become part of our community at the hospice. She has never left, and she sings in our choir. She's an ambassador. She works as a volunteer with us. And of course, that's another bit of heaven on earth, being part of a community and part of knowing that you belong somewhere. And that was something I think that Sandra would have really struggled with if she'd never come to us. Another bit of heaven that I see is about knowing that you matter to others. And I recall many years ago working in a hospice in Kent, and I used to look every day at the visitors list to see who had come into the hospice. And there was a man who had an extraordinary number of visitors. One day he had over 25. And I thought, this is absolutely extraordinary. When I went to see him, he told me that he'd fostered in his life 70 children. And nearly all of them came to say thank you to him before he died. What a great gift to him, but what a great gift he had been to them also. I'll never forget that. One of the best bits of hospice care, if you were to ask me, I think is the volunteer work that happens there. There are something like 120,000 volunteers that work in hospice care around the country, and we have about 1,000 of them at St. Christopher's. And they bring all sorts of things. We couldn't manage to do our job without their time, but actually it's around their humanity and the voluntary giving of their time. And I remember meeting a man when I was doing my research. He talked a lot about what was most valuable to him in response to my questions. And one of the things that he had lost was his own sense of self-worth. And when he came to the hospice, he began to rebuild it. And when I asked him who had helped him, he said it was knowing that people came in not because they were being paid, not because they were pursuing a career, but because they just wanted to be with him. And he had all sorts of hierarchies in his head. He said to me, just look at that lady over there. She's the wife of an eminent surgeon. Why on earth would she want to come in and see me every week? But she does. And for him, there was a really strong sense of being important. There's some really nice stuff that we do around helping people do something you love. And I've been very struck this year by the growth of the work that we do in our gym. Most people wouldn't know that a gym happens in a hospice. We have over 100 patients a week who come and use our gym. And times have changed. When I started in hospice care, we'd have tucked people up in blankets and pyjamas and cared for them absolutely. Now we really encourage them to get up and stay as well as they can. There was a young man in our hospice last year. He was in his midlife. He was a runner. He had a tumour in his head, and he'd come in for terminal care, and he was utterly miserable. And our physiotherapist went to see him, and she discovered he was a runner. She said, come down to our gym. He said, I can't. I don't want to be seen. He had quite a lot of disfigurement. And he said, I don't know if I can run. I'm so dizzy. So she waited till the end of the day, pulled the blinds down, gave him a cap, walked him down, and started the treadmill. And he said to her afterwards, that was the best 45 minutes I've had for ages. The first time I've been pain-free, and the most excited I've been about being able to use my body still. And he carried on running day in and day out until the day before he died. A little bit of heaven for him, I hope. The other thing that I see is some real healing in a hospice. And maybe that's a real surprise too. For many people, they've had every bit of curative care that they could have. And yet, I see people healed almost daily. There was one man who had had a pretty miserable life, and he came to the hospice pretty low, and he wrote a poem, not to me, it's on our wall, but I'll just read it to you quickly. And in it, he talks about the hope that he got from being there as a result of making friends and knowing that people believed in him. He wrote, "My heart contains a cavity, once dry and empty. Over the years, through sharp, repeated incidents of life, the pain seeped in, then swelled to form a dark, rich lake. So often now, my tears spill over. You can't mend that hole, nor dry past tears. But take my hand, and around the pond, we'll plant flowers to make a beautiful display." Let's move on then from heaven to hell. And I think that the glimpse of hell that I see most in the work that I do is around the loneliness of dying. It often isn't about people who don't have anybody around them. Often they have shed loads of family and friends. But the moment that you know that you are no longer going to be alive in a month, a year, 2 years, your whole experience and expectation of life changes. And people talked a lot about the loneliness of that. I remember meeting a man when I was doing my research who described it most clearly for me. He said, "It's gone on far too long. This has been the loneliest time in my life, and yet I've been surrounded with the most people. It's knowing how to cope with them. It's knowing how they're going to cope with you and then not with you. It's strange all round, it is." And I don't know that we can do anything about that except to be present with people. For some, dying takes too long. That's a rather surprising notion, even in the eyes of people who are directly affected. I met a man last week who was talking about living with a lung condition that he'd had for a long time, but which makes him increasingly disabled. He said, "The funny thing about this diagnosis is that it goes on too long. It's a funny thing to say because you think the longer you live, the better. But for everybody, my wife and my family, it just keeps on going and going." I have met some people for whom real hell exists because they are practically separated from people that are really important to them. Perhaps one of the saddest things I've seen is the mother who is in the hospice and who yearns for that visit from her son that she will never get because he's in prison. Sometimes we're lucky and we can find a way to change that. Increasingly, we have good relationships with either prison governors or others who can make something like that happen. But for many, it doesn't. And it's a harsh pain and one for which there is very little comfort. And then I see the hell that exists for staff and volunteers when we can't help. Quite often people say to me, "Isn't your work really difficult?" Particularly when I did lots of clinical work. And I would say honestly, no, it's fantastic. It's really good work. But when it's most difficult is when you know you haven't been able to help somebody. And that's the time when our staff and our volunteers struggle most. Moving on then very quickly to death itself. I think it was Woody Allen who said, "I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens." And for many of us like him, it's the bit of life that we dread most. It's the dying bit that's the most scary. Sandy said at the beginning, it's something we don't really want to think about, and that's a real problem for us. Our society has completely denied it for a long time now. If we'd lived 100 years ago, even 70 years ago, it would have been part of our everyday life. But many of us don't really believe that it's going to happen. And if I have met people who say to me things like, "If I die," well, of course, that's just nonsense. Everybody will die. In my experience, the very best deaths happen when people have had time to prepare. And conversely, the very worst ones are where people don't. When people have had time to talk about what they want, when they know what will happen, when they've negotiated the way that they would want it to be if it could be, those are the times when death happens best. It's never easy, but it's so much easier for families, for friends, and for professionals when everybody knows what somebody wants. What I would also say is that some of the people I've worked with have given me every indication that they know much more about what death is than I do. And I often wonder whether they are in a slightly different place and are no longer in the world that I am, even before they die. I've often observed people who say to me things like, I probably won't see you again, or thank you for everything you've done. I'm expecting to see them next week, but they're not expecting to see me. And more times than not, they were right. Who knows what's going on there? I certainly don't. But I'm clear that that moment, the moment when someone makes the transition from mortal life to death, is something beyond my understanding. But I'm not always sure it's beyond theirs. Lastly, let's think about judgment and redemption. When I was working at St. Joseph's, I had the privilege of working with lots and lots of Muslim people, their families and their communities. And those patients had more visitors than anybody else that I have ever known. Often they visited all night. They would come 24 hours a day in vast numbers. Our night staff hated it, you can imagine. They wanted to close down the lights and say goodnight to everybody, and there were shed loads of people coming in. And when I asked about that, I was told that it's a requirement for any Muslim to prepare for their death, and in so doing, to seek forgiveness from anyone for whom they had done wrong. It was part of the responsibility of the living and the dying, a part of a lifetime's job to prepare for death. And for me, personally, it's a hugely attractive aspect of the ritual of preparing for death. If there's one thing that I'm most concerned about in my own dying, it's failing to have put right those things I've done to people in the course of my life, and knowing that not only have I said that I'm sorry, but to have received forgiveness would be a great gift. That yearning for redemption is something that I see in my work regularly. I've just finished a hugely interesting academic project at Lancaster, which aims at improving end-of-life care for people in prison. We've been working in a prison for sex offenders in northwest England. In that context, many of the inmates look after each other, and particularly when someone's dying, they may do most of their personal care, they may get up with them in the night, help them eat, walk, and so on. And when one prisoner was talking about this, he spoke of kind things done by men with ugly faces. He went on to introduce me to an epilogue by John Masefield. Just four lines. I've seen flowers come in stony places, and kind things done by men with ugly faces, and the gold cup won by the worst horse at the races. So I trust too. This trust of something good, despite the challenges, the pain, the guilt, the shame, the apparent emptiness, the futility of effort for people who are dying or for people who are caring for them, is so important, and I see trust despite some of the very toughest situations. It's part of what sustains all of us involved in hospice life: patients, families, carers, staff, volunteers. A trust that something worthwhile, transformational even, despite declining health, significant and multiple losses, is trust that something will be triumphant despite our personal and professional frailties. I'll just finish now by coming back to Advent and to us here today. It is our chance to prepare for Christ's arrival in the world through the birth of Christ. It's a time to celebrate light in the midst of darkness, to be ready to receive the gift of new life. And never does that new life look as good as when you recognise the limitations of the one that you live currently. When I was doing my PhD, I was heavily pregnant towards the end. I spent 6 months in a daycare centre on the Isle of Wight, and during that time I had my baby, my first child, and then returned to finish doing my research. My growing girth and my anticipation of the new baby was so in contrast to the ever-shrinking sizes of many of the patients and their anticipation of death. And yet we coexisted very happily with each other. I was utterly looked after, and in return, I carried the promise of new life, a new beginning in which those people could share. When Phoebe was born, I took her back most days when I was collecting data. She couldn't have asked to belong to a more caring community who celebrated her arrival and her early life beyond anything I could have imagined. Some of my best memories of that time was of taking her back. When we arrived, there was always a welcoming committee, lots and lots of preparation, often a present or two, carefully chosen or made, and she only had to make the smallest sound before she was scooped up for a cuddle or four as I went off to do my interviews. What was her secret? She embodied the promise of life that many of those individuals knew was shortly no longer to be theirs. So my hope for me, and you, if you wish it, this Advent, is that I'll anticipate Christmas with a similar fervour and with a focus that recognises the futility of all those things around me that can preoccupy my thinking and my energy at this time of year. I hope I can remember what is important and ignore that which isn't. May God give me and you clarity, strength, and perseverance to be ready for the birth of Christ in 4 weeks' time. Amen.